Welcome to episode 10 of Living in Recovery, a podcast devoted to sharing the stories of fellow CBP employees who are living in recovery with an addiction. The focus of this podcast is to share the experiences of those who have struggled with alcohol or drugs in the hopes of breaking the stigma that's often associated with addiction. Also, the goal of this podcast is to stimulate hope amongst those who may be struggling but are discouraged or intimidated by the prospect of seeking help. As a disclaimer, the words expressed in this podcast are based on personal experiences alone and are not meant to be taken as medical advice or to promote one method of treatment. Today, Brett shares his recovery experience and how treatment helped him come to terms with his addiction. Now, Brett discusses what works for him in his approach to recovery. This part of episode 10 contains content that may be difficult for some listeners due to the reference to death or dying of a minor child. This content is meant to provide information and context that is relevant to Brett's experience. Listener discretion is advised.
My son experienced the same thing as me. He's in a level of depression that I read some of his work afterwards that it's scary how depressed he was. I didn't see that. Kids using drugs? Stop it. That's my only advice to him. Stop using drugs. So he meets this girl and she drives an ambulance. And I thought, oh, wow, she gets urinalysis. So if she gets a urinalysis, she's good. She's clean. All right. My son, and he got a job. He got fired from a few, but he's got a new job and a new girl, and the girl gets urinalysis. Fixed. I found a piece of duct tape that works. I came home 3:30 in the afternoon from work. His bedroom door was locked, which it's an indoor bedroom door. So that's odd. I'm banging on the door. I got no response. I stuck a screwdriver in there, opened it up, and he's laying on his bed. And I thought, this dumb kid just got high or something and missed his first day at work. I think he was supposed to start work at 3 o'clock that day. I went in there and I kicked him in his, I kicked him with my foot in his butt. I'm like, Jake, you missed work. Get up. Nothing. No response. So I leaned over and I saw that he had white stuff coming out of his mouth. At that point, I knew there was a problem and I pulled him off the bed and he was in rigor mortis already. He had been gone for a time. In all my law enforcement training, I knew what rigor was. I didn't bother me. I gave him CPR. I probably broke his ribs. Called 911, and my son was gone. And, oh, did that light the fire. If I was drinking heavy before, which I was, if you don't think I could get any worse, here it comes. This is when it went into overdrive, because this kind of pain is, it's unimaginable. I can't even describe it. My oldest son is now deceased. My wife has filed for divorce. At this point, my drinking became to the point where I can't live like this. I'm just going to drink myself to death. That's my remaining option at this point. This kind of pain I can't live with. I'm going to drink myself to death. And I drank. One thing I didn't do, believe it or not, I woke up probably still under the influence, but I felt I had a cup of coffee, took a shower. Felt great. Went to work. Didn't drink on the job. Never drank on the job. But I was looking at that clock all day, waiting for me to go home. And I thought when I could go home, I could have my first shot. And that's exactly what happened. When I got home from work, before I put my backpack down, I had one shot in my belly. And I would drink nonstop until I went to bed. And I couldn't sleep. I would pass out and wake up, pass out and wake up. So believe it or not, I went on Ambien for a little while. So I was drinking that much and taking Ambien. I would wake up 3 hours later after I went to bed on booze and Ambien. I would wake up 3 hours later. I wouldn't even think that would be possible, but it happened. So I wasn't sleeping at all. Also at work, by the way, as I was watching the clock, about 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon is when I started getting the shakes. That's when I was probably going through my first stage of withdrawal. So that's what makes me think that when I went to work, even though I felt completely fine, I could have probably registered on a breathalyzer. I didn't feel like I could, but I probably could have, that being said. So I was at work 5 days after my son died. On the job, at work, people are looking at me like, what are you doing here? What, are you okay? Oh, yeah, I'm good. I'm okay. You're not? Yeah, I'm sad, but I'm okay. My warrior coat was on. I had delayed stress at that point. My stress, my acute stress, believe it or not, the booze put that off. But it was coming. It's coming. I lived like that for months, every single day. I lived like that for months and months. My son died in October. I went to rehab in April, that many months. And then the stress kicks in. The delayed stress, the acute stress starts to happen. I start to now, even with all the booze, put together the parts of my life that have completely fell apart. The fact that my son is gone. My marriage is gone. And even my dog died in that 1 year. The trifecta. There are some people that ask me, how are you still standing? I have a sign over my door that says, I smile because I've took everything the world threw at me and I got back up. That's why I smile. And I just hit it and hit it. When I urinated, sometimes it was orange. I had really bad stomach aches, which turns out was pancreatitis, which is one of the side effects. But I drove my 900-pound motorcycle around Jacksonville, blackout drunk with no helmet on, at night, everywhere. I was doing pretty much everything I could to die because I could not take that anymore. I did not want to be here. I wasn't at the intentional suicide yet. This is called unintentional suicide. This is the suicidal thoughts. I don't really want to kill myself, but I'm going to do extremely risky things because I don't care if I die. In fact, it would be better if I died because I can't function. And I don't know how to live like this. My whole life, I've been able to take care of business. I was a pilot. I was a cop, always the top of my class and everything I did. And everything came to this point in my life. And I lost control and I never thought that could happen to me. But it was that point where all those thoughts running rampant through my head. At this point now, the tolerance, the pain level, the depression level gets stronger than the alcohol can work. Your tolerance is too high now. It doesn't work anymore. So you're trying to get it to work. It doesn't work. What you're doing now is you don't reach the drunk that you're looking for. You get to the point where you get a buzz. After you get a buzz, you skip right to sick. There's no drunk. What happened to my drunk? I have to drink more. That's it. Keep drinking more. Now I'm throwing up. Now I can't even put my pants on, but I'm not drunk. What's going on? And you just think, okay, I just need more and more. Yeah, at the end there, bottle a day, easy. Sometimes a little more. And that was from, remember I said I got off at work at 3:30, 4 o'clock. That was from 4 o'clock to bedtime. So that's not all day drinking. That's 4 o'clock till about 11 o'clock, drinking a whole fifth of tequila. And I would buy handles at a time. So I'd say maybe sometimes more because I would look at the handle and the hand. I'd wake up in the morning and go, how did I drink that much? Because it didn't knock me out. I just kept drinking because I need this pain to go away. I just kept drinking and kept drinking, not even realize how much I was drinking at that point. And that leads me to that fateful night where I said, this is it. This is the time. And just before I got up, I made the phone call. So
you called Steve.
That's it. I called Steve. And the rest is history. Now I'm 4.5 years sober, and I'm going to tell you I have experienced things that I never thought were possible. I go to sunrise meetings at the beach. Like the colors are clear now. It's hard to explain, but things are clear. I do forget a lot because I'm in my 50s, but I remember more than I ever did. Just the friends that I have now. I have a girlfriend for 4 years now that I'm with. She's a psychiatrist down here, and she would never have dated. She calls it Brett 2.0. So Brett 1.0, she said, no way at all. Everybody has come up to me and said how happy they are for me. I've had people tell me that I've helped them. Even just my story has helped them. I have people tell me I look fantastic. I lost almost 50 pounds, 45 pounds. I was almost diabetic. I was stepping right into type 2. I actually reversed my A1C. My high blood pressure went away. They took me off the meds. Now, believe it or not, I have low blood pressure. I have never been in this kind of shape ever that I'm in now. I work out. I'm getting up early, piece of cake, cup of coffee. I'm snapping and whistling on the way to work. Asking me that 4 years ago, I would think that's a fantasy. That's only in the movies. No way. It's just amazing. It was hard, though. It was really hard. The first year was really tough. Year to year and a half was really hard. I had to stay away from booze completely. I couldn't go out with my friends. When I went on the road with work, first of all, it took me 18 months to get my pilot license back. So I had to work with the FAA. I got in the HIMSS program with the FAA. My job was completely supported. The FAA works with you. I hired this consultant that worked with me with the FAA. It's a pain in the butt to get your license back. A couple grand and some patience, and I'm flying again just like I was before. Only probably safer because I'm not drinking now. So
talking about how the HIMSS program was a little different than your treatment program. I don't think a lot of folks understand the difference there.
Oh, okay. The HIMSS program is basically, if you get a waiver for the FAA, if you have any kind of health issue that requires a waiver to continue flying, and this could be from cancer, vision problems, blood pressure, anything, they have a section on the FAA, and it's the HIMSS program. With each problem they have categorized, and in my case, it's substance abuse, there is a checklist that they run down, and you have to get, let's see what I had to do. I had to do 90 AA meetings in 90 days. And that's a standard AA practice anyways. Forget the FAA. If you're new to AA, they're going to say, hit 90 meetings in 90 days. And the FAA adheres to that as well. The other thing they do is they make you go see a neuropsychologist, and you have to get evaluated to see if you did any damage up here in your brain with the alcohol. Because if you're going to fly airplanes again, they want to make sure there is a condition called wet brain, which is where you drink to the point where you've actually caused permanent brain malfunctions like memory and stuff. So you have to get evaluated there. You have to get evaluated by another psychiatrist to make sure that you're handling the issue that caused you to drink, but you're working on that. So I had basically my FAA psychiatrist, my therapist, my regular psychiatrist, and a neuropsychiatrist all putting things in order up here and make me think about. And then I have to do a urinalysis 14 times a year. I have to, which I still do, I have to see that my medical used to be once a year. Now my medical has to take place every 6 months. And as you progress in the program, if you pass all these things and all these doctors sign off on it, then eventually you'll get your FA medical back. And I'm still under restrictions. I still have to do the urinalysis. I still have to see I have two FAA doctors. One does my physicals and one handles my alcohol waiver. I have to see her, the alcohol one, every 6 months physically. So I have to actually drive to Birmingham, Alabama. We sit for 20 minutes and I drive home. It's a pain in the butt, but I love flying. So I do what I have to keep flying. But there is no reason that anybody, as bad a shape as I was, I'm flying again. My peer pilot flies for American Airlines. He has also been through the program. As you get senior in the program, as the years go by, they start shaving off requirements. Like they won't have me do so many urinalysis, or they won't have me do so many physicals. And then eventually it drops off and you're back to normal. So they have a monitoring program that lasts for several years. But if you love flying, it's worth it. And they have, the FAA has a 94% success rate keeping people off the sauce. Have your job in their hands. So that's a big motivation factor. But I really wanted to hit one thing is that after about year two, I am now can sit up belly up to the bar with all my friends and have a bottle of water in my hand. Does not cross my mind. Doesn't bother me at all.
Wow.
And someone asked me how I do it. It's like, it, to me right now, I don't like avocados. So if I have dinner, I say no avocados. To me, it's booze is like, yeah, no, thanks. I'll just have the water. Thank you. You know, and completely fine with it. Our society is so cultured into drinking that it's actually a big, huge relief to me that I don't have to drink. I can have just as much fun. One of the biggest compliments I ever got was my friend here down here told me that I was the exact same guy as I was drinking. That was the biggest compliment I ever got because I always thought that I was not me unless I was drunk. That was my validation. And now one of the things that scared me when I was getting sober was, what am I going to do without drinking? Who am I going to be without drinking? And when my friend told me that, it lit me up like a candle. I was very positive.
So it was you.
It was me.
They liked, it wasn't
It was me without the booze. Imagine that.
Wow. The HIMSS program, by the way, stands for Human Intervention Motivation Study.
That's it. And I know a lot of pilots on the in the HIMSS program. There is the myth is that you're done. And that is not the case. The guys that have gotten popped for flying under the influence are still flying. The guys that have gotten actually arrested on the airplane for flying under the influence, now they might have lost their job with that company, because that company has probably lost faith in them, but they got their medicals back. They got their licenses back and they're flying somewhere else, but they are flying. You're going to do more damage. Worst case, you're going to hurt yourself or someone else. Best thing for you is you'll get caught and fired. And then it's not a pleasant thing to go through, but if you recognize, I always tell people that I've helped. I got a call from a pilot, a CBP pilot that had recently retired. And he called me up out of the blue. And I barely even talked to this guy while he was working. He worked in a different office, but I knew of him. He called and he asked me, he's like, how do you do it? How do you do it? And I said, okay, what's going on? And he told me some of the things he was going through. And he was obviously drinking a lot. Day drinking. He's retired. He wasn't doing anything. Day drinking all day long. His wife of 41 years is really upset with him. He doesn't know if the marriage is going to hold together. And immediately my brain went to what I was taught, why the need to drink so much. He kept mentioning the fact that he was the tip of the spear. 40 years military service and customs service. I was on my game. I was on my game. He kept saying that, even though we weren't really talking about his job. And I said, okay, you went from running 100 miles an hour to a full stop and doing nothing. So do you think that might have something to do with you feeling unappreciated? And he's like, yeah, a little bit. I was like, okay, we're getting somewhere. So you feel this unappreciated, you feel bad. And now you're escaping like I did. And he actually said to me, oh, you know what? Oh my goodness. Wow. I don't know if I haven't spoke to him since. I don't know if I've helped him or not. Like I said, I just tell my story. I try to help people. Sometimes it works. It has not worked before. I have two people I worked on that are really bad and didn't take my advice at all or my help at all. But I've had other people tell me I really helped them. And if I can just get one person to realize that there's life after booze, it's so nice to not feel pressured to drink. It's so nice to not have to drink. It's so nice to be able to have as much fun. I dance now. People look at me like I have three heads. What do you mean you're dancing now? And I'm dancing sober. That's the thing that blows them away. And so I just try my best. And this is what I try to get people to look at when they're trying to evaluate why they're drinking so much or why they're feeling bad.
And what do you think it is that sustains your recovery now?
I got a lot of things. In AA, they call it the higher power. A lot of people, it means different things to different people. To me, what keeps me going, which is my higher power, what keeps me sober, is I have a lot of things that I constantly look at. My other two children are basically, they saved my life, I think, because it was them I was thinking about when I made that call to Steve, even though I can't really remember. But Steve said right away, I mentioned my other two kids, my girlfriend, my job, just my life I have now. The memory of going through hell, going to the bottom of the barrel and shaking hands with the devil himself, and then trying to pull out of that barrel it was hard. It was one of those things. It's like someone goes to boot camp and they graduate boot camp and they're already in the military and they say, you know what? I think I want to go back to boot camp. Everyone's going to go, what? All these things keep me going. All these motivating factors keep me going. I have a new look on life. AA's taught me a lot. I look at each day as a gift, one day at a time. I don't worry about the past. What happened in my past happened, and there's nothing I can do to fix it. I accept what I've done, even the bad things, and I've learned from those mistakes, and I move forward. The future I can't predict, so I do the best I can. I don't take anything personally. I don't make assumptions, and I be as honest as I can be. I'm true to my word. Some people say maybe sometimes too honest, but I come right out and I'll tell someone right away, yeah, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And some people are like, whoa, I don't hold anything back. I lay it on the table and I am who I am. And I don't take offense to anybody who doesn't like what I said or who doesn't like me anymore. I just like, I live my life. The serenity prayer is accept the things you cannot change and have courage to change the things you can. I live by that every single day. And it keeps me going.
Wow. What would you say to someone who might be trying to decide if they should seek help, and why should they even bother when there are understandable reasons why they started drinking in the first place?
I would say, I always tell people that first step in AA, that's the most important step and the easiest step. And I always tell people, evaluate what's going on in your life. If you're powerless against alcohol, when I say that, I say, you cannot have a drink. You cannot go without having a drink. And then at the same time, your life is becoming unmanageable. And what I mean by that is, you're calling out sick because you're hungover. Your marriage is falling apart. You're missing an event, a family event, a kid's school thing, because you're either drunk or hungover or feel bad from the night before. If those two things are going on in your life, you have to have a serious conversation with yourself. Some people can do that. But if you are to the point where your alcohol is causing a lot of major problems in your life and in your health, and you can't seem to put that alcohol down, then I would say you probably need some help. A lot of cops, a lot of first responders, we are horrible at seeking help. Horrible. And I'm no different. I could handle it. I went to work 5 days after my son died. I can handle it. There's where we're wrong. We are all wrong. everybody needs a hand every now and again. I had a training day with my office where I said, talk to somebody. Communication is the key. Communication is amazing. And if you think you need help, go ask, go get some help. No one's going to look down on you. My office, and I think all of CBP, I'd like to thank all of CBP, will give you what you need if you need that kind of help. And rehab does more than just stop you from drinking. Rehab teaches you not only what alcohol is doing to you, but rehab is going to teach you what's going on in your life that's maybe causing this problem that you're abusing alcohol. It's an amazing experience to go through. Now, again, going through withdrawals, coming out of rehab, still craving alcohol a little bit. That's a bumpy road. But it is, looking back now, it taught me so much. It really did. Anybody can look me up in the web telly, or if anybody's got a question that they want to ask me personally, I will take all phone calls and emails. I will turn nobody away. If you're thinking about it, but you're on the edge and you don't know what to do and you want to talk to a complete stranger about it in a judgment-free phone call or email that won't say anything to anybody, give me a call, give me an email. And you can look me up and I'll do the best I can.
Awesome. Thanks, Brett.
Thank you. It actually helps me to tell my story. Believe it or not, it's therapy for me. So to tell my story helps me. So it really does.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Living in Recovery. If you or someone you know needs help, reach out to the Employee Assistance Program to reach a licensed clinician at 1-800-755-7002. For additional resources related to the Alcohol and Substance Misuse Prevention Program, please visit the CBP Workforce Care Directorate page on CBPNet. You can also send questions directly to cbpresilience@cbp.dhs.gov. Thank you for listening to part 2 of episode 10. Check out part 1 of episode 10 to hear the beginning of Brett's episode.